Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, immigration reform. This summer, it was the hot issue in Washington, but then it took a back seat to the government shutdown and the debt ceiling. Now it's back, and two Valley Republicans are taking high-profile positions in favor of a comprehensive immigration bill that would include a pathway to citizenship for those in the country illegally. We'll talk with Hanford Republican David Valadao and learn why this is an issue on which he's willing to break with his party's leadership in the House. We'll also hear why a pharmacist may soon be playing a bigger role in providing your primary care here in California, thanks to a new law recently signed by Governor Brown. And we'll learn about a new hub for the arts in downtown Fresno that's opening this month. That and much more, all coming up on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. Former State Senator Dean Flores has been fined $60,000 by the state's Fair Political Practices Commission over allegations that he used campaign funds for personal expenses. The Shafter Democrat had planned a run for lieutenant governor, but later withdrew from the race. The commission alleges he spent $26,000 in money from donors on personal purchases ranging from furniture to airfare. The commission also says Flores failed to return $247,000 in campaign funds to donors. College is a goal for the majority of Latinos graduating from California high schools. But as Katie Orr reports, a new report out today shows few Latinos actually finish college.
The study from the organization, the Campaign for College Opportunities, finds 7 out of 10 California Latino high school graduates enrolled in college last year. But just 11% of Latino adults in the state have a bachelor's or graduate degree. Michelle Siqueiros is the group's executive director. She says closing that gap is crucial as Latinos make up more of the state's native-born population.
I think sometimes there's a misperception that Latinos are mostly immigrant. That's certainly not true in California, and certainly not true for our young kids that are in school today. 95% of them were born here.
Siqueiros says Latinos are more likely to go to community college and more likely to attend classes part-time. They make up a relatively small portion of the student bodies at UC and CSU schools. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
A Clovis man has pled guilty to pointing a laser at a Fresno County Sheriff's Department helicopter. According to court documents, 23-year-old Charles Conrad Mahaffrey of Clovis pointed a red laser at Eagle One, forcing it to abort its mission. A new law signed last year by President Obama makes it a federal crime to knowingly point a laser at an aircraft. Mahaffrey faces a maximum sentence of 5 years of prison time and a $250,000 fine. According to the FBI, there have been over 2,500 incidents of lasers being pointed at an aircraft reported in the U.S. this year. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Exactly 1 year from today will be the midterm election. And that means before politicians go back out on the campaign trail, there's one last chance to pass big legislation, including things like immigration reform. Earlier this year, there was a lot of talk from both sides of the political spectrum about the issue, but it sort of took a back seat with the attention paid to the debt ceiling, to the fiscal cliff, to the rollout of Obamacare. Now a couple of Republican congressmen from the Valley have injected themselves into the immigration debate in a new way by co-sponsoring a Democratic bill for comprehensive immigration reform, including a pathway to citizenship, border security, and a work program. One of them was Jeff Denham. The other, David Valadao, who I spoke with yesterday about immigration reform and a host of other issues important to residents of the Valley.
Congressman Valadao, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Last week, you joined your colleague Jeff Denham to become one of only three members of the GOP to sign on as co-sponsors of H.R. 15, the Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act. This bill would address comprehensive immigration reform and also address border security and some other things as well. It includes a pathway to citizenship, as it's called. Why this move and why now?
Well, we've been talking about immigration reform for the last 11 months, and I've only been in Congress for 11 months, and I've been getting a lot of commitments and a lot of promises, and I've been having a lot of conversations with both sides of the aisle. And now closing or getting close to the end of the year, I'm starting to see that it's fallen off to the side a little bit. I mean, there are some big issues facing our country, so I'm not going to deny that. But immigration is one that is important to my constituents. It is one that is important to my district as well. So it's something that I wanted to make sure leadership knew. I wanted to make sure everybody knew that let's move this. I'm serious about this conversation. This is how serious I am. Let's sign on to a bill. Let's have this conversation.
There's discussion among political observers in Washington that there could be a number of members of the GOP who would vote for this bill if it comes up to a vote. But getting it to a vote is another issue. You're working with Speaker Boehner and others in the House leadership to try to do this. What are your thoughts on moving this forward and getting it to a vote?
Well, this bill, as it's written today, is not perfect. Jeff Denham, he had a few additions he wanted to make to it. I've talked to Joe Garcia, the author, about it, and there are some things I want to adjust in it as well. What I'm asking for right now is to start to have that debate in committee on the floor. We know, and everybody sits around, points fingers, and says, look, we know this is wrong with it. We know that's wrong with it. Well, then, if we know what's wrong with it, why not have that debate and start to make those changes and improve it? We know the problem's there. We know what's wrong with the bill. We know what needs to be done. Let's have that debate.
What are some of those concerns you have?
Well, for me, some of the concerns are specifically on some of the guest worker programs and some of the definitions and how they are across the how that definition affects the bill in general. I mean, if they break it down the step-by-step approach the way the House wants to do it, those definitions don't quite affect each other quite as much as in a comprehensive bill. But it is important to make sure that if we define a certain role as something, that it doesn't affect other portions of the bill in a negative way, so that it makes some of the guest worker programs unworkable. And the whole purpose of immigration reform is obviously visas for people that want to immigrate here the legal way, making sure that our guest worker programs are working the legal way so that people have those opportunities. And that's something that I think is very important and we should be focusing on.
How does this differ from the Senate bill?
Well, the Senate bill 744 is a little bit different, but it, for the most part, everything except for some of the border security measures in there, is the Senate version. They took the Senate version, stripped out some controversial border security language in there, and replaced it with the McCall Amendment, which McCall Amendment passed out of committee, bipartisan support. I think it was almost unanimous. And it's a good bill that actually helps with or ensures that we have a secure border. And it was a bipartisan piece of legislation, so I think it makes sense to put that on there.
You've received a lot of attention nationally for your stance on this issue. A lot of folks have observed that your district is around 70% Latino. Your district is also a heavily agriculture district, and ag interests have been pushing for some sort of immigration legislation for some time. What do you think this would mean for the Valley?
Well, it would mean that we would have a good, honest supply of labor, especially on the ag side. The guest worker side is important to us. I'm an ag guy myself. I grew up on a dairy. I still own a dairy today. And I spent a lot of time back in Washington talking about immigration reform. So it's not a new topic to us. It is something that's important to us. And I think even for most farmers in general, it's important to them as well. I mean, water is always top of the list for us. And that's something that we want to make sure we focus on and spend a lot of time on. But immigration is something that's there, and it's something that's always coming up. And the stronger the administration comes in and starts to enforce the laws, especially when you get into E-Verify and those, if they leave that hole there with no guest worker program, it puts agriculture and the economy of the Valley in a really tough spot.
There's an internal debate going on in the GOP and has been for some time about the GOP's relationship with Latinos and Latino voters. There's some people who say without some movement on this issue, the GOP faces an uncertain future electorally. There's others that say if the Republican Party gives in on this issue, that it could mean a new voting bloc for Democrats. How do you view the Republican Party's relationship with Latinos here in the Central Valley and beyond, and how does this fit into that?
Well, I think as far as any piece of legislation that we ever work on, doesn't matter if it's immigration, health care, whatever, if we had always address everything in a partisan way, it will always end up losing. We have to address this from a person's perspective, from a human perspective. And I think when we work on legislation like immigration reform, if you do it just for political reasons, you're probably going to do something wrong. You've got to do it for the right reasons. And we all know there's something wrong with immigration reform, with the immigration system. So we have to have some type of reform to it. And I think that Republicans coming to the table and having that conversation, honest debate about it, not just talking points, not just pointing out what's wrong with the system, but have an honest debate about it, I think will give us a lot more credibility on the issue and other issues, and it'll help us quite a bit. And it'll be good for the country in general.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Congressman David Valadao. Turning to Washington, do you think anything has changed in the nation's capital since the shutdown and the aftermath? Has it made it more difficult to try to address something like immigration reform? Has it changed the political calculus in other ways moving forward on some other priorities? The farm bill is something I want to ask you about in a moment. What's changed?
Well, during this whole shutdown, the most frustrating part for Republicans in the House was that the administration never wanted to sit down, never wanted to talk to us. The Senate, we would offer bills. We would. I think the fourth bill that we offered was conference committee. Let's sit down and talk. We know there are problems here, and we need to talk about them. Let's work through this. And the fact that no one wanted to sit down and talk made it really difficult for future legislation, even immigration, farm bill, anything else, because it does make it hard to trust the other side. It does make it hard to work with the administration when you come to a situation like this where it was really for politics more than policy.
Republicans failed in the effort to defund or delay the president's health care law. Most political observers would probably agree that stopping implementation of the law at this point is unlikely. Obviously, members of both parties, though, have concerns about the law moving forward, certain provisions and things that we learn more about as the law progresses and the mandate rolls forward. The rollout of the Health Insurance Exchange website has been subject of considerable concern. Where do we go from here in your view? Are there certain elements that can be looked at that maybe Democrats and Republicans could agree that, you know, we need to reopen this and look at this particular portion of the law? Is there some piecemeal approach maybe to refining the law?
Well, and that's one of the issues we face is this law was passed without many, if anybody, actually reading it. And that's a bad thing to do, any piece of legislation you ever work on. Now we're starting to see those things. And now, after this big fight, you're starting to get Democrats to the table and say, look, we know this is bad. But they were there before the shutdown. They were there before the implementation of the law. Now it's just becoming more apparent because everybody is focused on that issue. Is there an opportunity? Yeah, there's always an opportunity. We've introduced legislation after legislation and actually passed out of the House from repeals to delays in certain parts. I mean, there's even the health care with the tax on medical device that 78 or 79 members of the Senate have signed on to that they want to repeal it. So there is a lot of bipartisan support out there. It just depends on how much the administration wants to sit down and talk about it. I mean, when you've got the Secretary Sebelius coming in and saying the website's never failed, when it's actually failed at the exact moment she's saying that, I mean, it tells you that there's not a whole lot of sincerity, and it'll make the negotiations difficult in the future.
I just want to follow up on something you said in regards to the medical device tax. Do you think that there maybe is off the record in the private circles in Washington and things like that, is there more of a spirit of bipartisanship perhaps than we realize this in reading the headlines and the talking points? Is there maybe some optimism for progress and common ground?
In general, back in Washington, and just like my time in Sacramento, whenever there's a debate going on and the cameras are on, it's not against the press or anything bad to say about them, but they do have to sell airtime. They do have to pay their bills. Saying something interesting, different, or outside of the norm gets people interested in paying attention to their station or paying attention to those headlines. And they have to report on those. But those are usually not the norm of either side of the aisle. I have groups that I meet with. One is No Labels. One is Unified Solutions. No Labels is all sides, Democrats, Republicans, all levels, from Senate to every class of Congress. Unified Solution is strictly members of Congress, first class, the 113th class, Republicans, Democrats, a few of us get together, and we talk about different issues. And it's always interesting to sit down and ask, what have you heard in your district? What are they telling you on this issue or that issue? Is there room for us to work together? And there are a lot of us who do like to have those conversations and do work well together, and we're going to continue to do that. But it is a little bit different than what the average person sees at home, and it's just because of the way things are.
Turning to an issue that has bipartisan interest here in the Valley, and that's water. Valley farmers face the potential, if we have another dry year, in some cases of as severe as a zero allocation. What are you hearing from growers and farmers, but what do you think the chances of seeing some federal action on water moving forward in this Congress and next?
Well, 1837 was passed out of the House last year, and that was passed. That was Congressman Nunes's bill. And it was a bill that really addressed a lot of our water issues. The Senate didn't do anything to take it up or have the debate. I looked at a few pieces of legislation that I thought were moving through the House and trying to attach something to it that would help at least relax some of the Endangered Species Act regulations so that we can run those pumps. What we're hearing right now and what we're seeing quite a bit, anybody that drives out in the country is going to see a lot of well trucks, well drilling trucks running around, working on the side of the road, drilling water wells. People are desperate. I've drilled two wells personally on my farm. I've got a well in one of my ranches that's pulled out of the ground right now. They're working on to see what they can do. All my neighbors are putting in wells. And when you start drilling wells, some of these guys are spending upwards of $1 million a hole in the ground. And when you've got the west side looking at a 0% allocation this coming year, people are scared. And when you start to make these when we come into this time of the year where we've got to start making decisions for the next year, what are you going to plant? What are you going to grow? You've got to tell your banker, well, this is the amount of water I'm going to have. This is what I can do or what I can't do. I mean, it's getting to a really hectic time. So we're going to have to find a way to get the Senate to the table and have this conversation to see if we can get this figured out as quick as possible, because this is something that is going to be very, very tough on the Valley.
Speaking of agriculture, the Farm Bill is in conference right now. When the House returns to Washington after Veterans Day, what are you looking for with that bill?
Well, as far as the Senate and the House versions, they're pretty similar. There's one provision in there that's pretty important to the Valley. I mean, the area that I represent is the largest dairy district in the country. The 21st has more cows than anywhere else in the country. And there's a provision in there specifically for dairy that the House does not want, or House leadership does not want. Colin Peterson has said he will not pass a farm bill without it, and then the Senate is okay with it. And it's a Dairy Security Act that if you decide to be part of one of the programs that are out there, when production gets too high and consumers aren't buying your product, they come in and say, well, you've got to reduce your production by a small percentage to try to get in line. And I think that's not a bad thing. I mean, when consumers aren't buying your product but the government's writing you a check, you shouldn't be producing a product no one is buying. And I think that's the government's way of coming in and saying, look, we'll protect you from going broke so that we can protect our food supply, but we don't want you overproducing the marketplace to hurt yourself in the long run. And I think that's a responsible place to be, but we'll see how it plays out. It's going to be probably one of the tougher fights on the policy side. Obviously, on the food stamp side, there's some big differences between the Senate and the House version, and where they're going to fall in the middle, it's anybody's guess right now.
Speaking of the dairy industry, California dairy operators have been hit hard over the past couple of years, really. The state has its own pricing system that's different from the federal system, and that's been a source of concern for a lot of folks in the industry. Where do you see the future of the dairy industry? As somebody who makes his living doing that, when you aren't in Washington and your family has a long history in that industry, what's the health of the California dairymen?
Well, we've had obviously quite a few tough years, and just last week, another dairyman actually committed suicide. So it's been tough. I've lost at least three friends that I personally know that took their own lives in the last few years, and so a friend of mine just this past week, who had just sold his dairy, and times were tough for him. But the issue that we face is the pricing system. And the California Secretary of Agriculture is in a funny spot with the way she prices milk. She's got to rely on studies, but those studies they're not quite the same as what they used to be when there was more processors out there. Now it's very consolidated. There's only a few out there. And whatever information they can gather from that, they can't use that for public pricing because it would basically release personal information of these specific companies. And it just gotten to that point where now we need to find a new way to price. And the fight has been on the weigh component specifically of our pricing system. And the pricing system is very, very complicated. But the weigh component is something that California dairymen feel like we've gotten the short end of the stick on because over the last 10 years, and I've been really engaged in this fight as a dairy farmer and now as a congressman, because the rest of the country is paying their dairymen fairly for the whey component, and California is not. And what we've done, or at least what I've done, I introduced a piece of legislation. Senator Feinstein introduced the same piece of legislation, and my piece of legislation is actually in the Farm Bill. And what it'll do when the Farm Bill is passed will allow California dairymen the opportunity to petition the federal government to start a federal pricing system for California. And it'll put us more in line with the rest of the country so that California dairymen aren't always disadvantaged when times are bad or times are good. I mean, if the other guys are taking advantage of something that they produce and we produce the same product but we're not getting the same price, our California guys have always got one arm tied behind their back, and it just makes it tough for them to compete.
Back to one more thing with the Farm Bill. You mentioned the food stamp component, and that's been a controversial element of that bill as it was passed in the House. Republicans sought a rather significant cut over around 10 years in the food stamp program. The numbers in that program have grown substantially over the past few years. The San Joaquin Valley is an area that has very, very high food insecurity. What are your thoughts on that program and its effectiveness right now? Is it something that we can afford to cut? Is it something that we can afford not to cut? Where do you stand on that?
Well, the Senate passed and the House both passed legislation, Farm Bill, that made cuts to food stamps. So both sides agree that there has to be some trimming. The difference in that number is pretty wide. And I voted against the House version. I thought it was just too much at this time, especially when the government has come in and caused a lot of our problems. When you look at what's going on with the water situation, the federal government is the one that's in the place to fix this, and they haven't. They haven't addressed it. When you look at what's going on in the dairy provisions or the dairy industry, it's, again, the government that's there. And I just had a tough time as someone that's here to represent my district in federal government making those decisions when our branches are failing to fix the problems too. And so I'd like to see something come from this, a good number that doesn't hurt my constituents, but also helps save the government money, because we all know that there's always going to be some fraud and some abuse, and we have to trim that, and we have to make sure that goes away. But at the same time, we've got to fix the issues, the overlying issues that have the real impact and force people into those types of programs, and that's great jobs.
One last question before we go. High-speed rail. You've been a vocal critic of the high-speed rail program in California. You've called it extravagant and unnecessary. Kings County has been a hotbed of opposition from this. Kings County supervisor was quoted the other day saying, "We can't afford to lose a single acre of ag land to high-speed rail. We don't want it, whether it's this route or that route or another route." There is a concern I've heard from some people who are in the first section of railway. They're standing to lose, as other people throughout the valley standing to be relocated or lose their farms or lose portions of their land, that we will be left with a 30-something mile stretch of track that we'll spend a whole lot of money to do. It seems like that probably is going to move forward. We'll see where that lawsuit goes, but it's quite possible that it does move forward, that we're going to be left with this really expensive piece of track that ultimately cost a lot of money, but by stopping future expenditures on high-speed rail isn't really useful beyond just serving as a regular rail line. In terms of the long-term vision, where do you see California's role in trying to, and the federal government's role with high-speed rail? Is there ever a scenario you can see where high-speed rail is something viable? Maybe it's not, I understand your opposition, maybe it's not at this time, but do you ever see a chance for this to get off on the right foot?
Well, I actually think that the rush to build this one the way it is planned is the biggest problem. As far as in general, ever in the future, no, I always think there's an opportunity. I think you should always keep your options open and your mind open to these new ideas. But when the federal government came in right before the 2010 election cycle and dropped 700 $700 million, but a total of there's about $3 billion in federal dollars coming to this thing. I mean, $3 billion is such a small percentage of the overall cost, but they showed up and said, here's $3 billion, and that's a lot of money, and said, you've got to spend it as fast as possible by 2017. And we didn't even have, and we still don't to this day, have an alignment. We don't know where it's going to be built. We don't have a real plan. We don't know what it's going to cost someone to ride it. We don't know what it's going to cost to build it. I mean, there's a lot of unknowns there. And now we've got such a small amount of money on the overall scheme of – or the overall size of the project, but still a lot of money to the average person to hurry up and start building this project. And I think that's our biggest mistake. I think that if you're serious about this, let's have a serious conversation. If you're serious about building anything, if it's your business, if it's your house, if it's anything, you don't walk in the door and say, look, I'm not sure what my plan is. I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but I've got this money in my pocket and I've got to start building today. I mean, that's just not a good plan anyway, anywhere. It has to be done right. And so I'd like to see them slow it down. I'd like to see them forget about the $3 billion, allow the federal government to use that money for something more useful, and leave it on the shelf and start to talk about this in a more sincere way instead of just let's build as fast as we can because we've got this money burning a hole in our pocket. Project in general, this one today, I offered an amendment to, Washington in appropriations. All my amendment said was the Surface Transportation Board has to approve this project in its entirety. Well, why did I ask for that? Well, because I don't believe they have a plan. And if they have a plan, show us your plan, put it on paper, and get a permit based on that plan for the whole project. Because this isn't a little regional rail. This is something that's going to be built across the whole state. And it's going to affect everybody in the state. And you can't start to spend money on something when you don't have a plan for the whole project. If you don't know where your end game is, why do you want to start? And then when you look at my portion of the valley, we've got Amtrak going through our district. And I've got three stations. I've got Hanford, Corcoran, and Wasco. Those are the only three stations I actually have in my district. We've got from Bakersfield down to L.A., we have to ride a bus to get into L.A. So we're going to build a very expensive rail, right next to some points, at some points literally sharing the same right-of-way, and others a couple miles away when we should be filling in the gaps. I mean, there's just a lot of things that need to be done first. And I just feel like they're doing this all wrong. So it's been a challenge, and obviously my constituents aren't thrilled with it. And when you talk to them, I mean, there is some that are supportive, but for the most part, most of them are opposed to this project. And so I've got to do my best to represent my constituents and their dollars.
Republican Congressman David Valadao joining us today on Valley Edition. Congressman Valadao, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Really enjoyed it.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment to tell you why your pharmacist may be playing a bigger role in your primary care in the coming months and years here in California. That and much more straight ahead on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The Central Valley has long been a hotspot for the fungal disease known as Valley Fever. But for the most part, it hasn't been a hotspot for research into the disease. That is, until now. That's because some of the top medical researchers in the Valley are coming together, and they're inviting the public to help. FM89's Rebecca Plevin tells us more.
This Saturday, community members are invited to attend Valley Fever Research Day at the UCSF Fresno Center for Medical Education and Research. The event is an opportunity for researchers from UCSF Fresno, UC Merced, and Fresno State to connect with community members who have been impacted by the disease. Paul Brown is the director of the Health Sciences Research Institute at UC Merced.
The goals for the event is to help us as researchers understand more about Valley Fever and about the impact on people's lives, and to form partnerships that we can then start to go ahead and to make some changes and address some of the issues to improve people's lives.
He says community input could shape research into the disease.
We know that, you know, change has to be made sort of in partnership with communities, not from above.
The forum is one of the first steps in a plan to develop a regional consortium focused on the disease. Michael Peterson, the chief of medicine for the UCSF Fresno Medical Education Program, says university researchers are interested in collaborating with public health departments and area doctors to create a virtual Valley Fever Center. It would be similar to the Valley Fever Center for Excellence at the University of Arizona.
There's not necessarily a bricks and mortar building that you go and you point to, but rather it's a center that brings together people and expertise where they are collaborating and communicating and not necessarily always being in the same room.
The goal, he says, is to work together to address issues related to Valley Fever, like improved prevention, detection, and treatment of the disease. It could also drum up research funding.
No one of us has the entire picture, but all of us together can really begin to address the full picture of this disease.
He says a plan and timeline for the virtual center has not been established, but
the Valley has really waited a very long time for something like this to come together, and I don't see any reason why, with the interest that we have, that we can't push on a fairly aggressive timeline.
Valley Fever Research Day is free and open to the public. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And you can learn more about our ongoing coverage of this story. It goes back over a year as part of the Just One Breath series on our website, kvpr.org. And that series is a joint effort of Valley Public Radio and our partners in the Reporting on Health Collaborative. Two-thirds of California regions already fall short of the federally recommended primary care doctor supply, including the Central Valley. As the Affordable Care Act is implemented and more Californians gain insurance, the burden on the state's primary care providers will increase. In this California Healthline report by Rachel Dornhelm, experts discuss legislative efforts to address the state's provider shortage.
Thank you for calling Covered California. My name is Tasha. Is this your first time calling?
There is a steady hum in the Concord call center for Covered California. 140 agents work to sign people up for coverage through the new Health Insurance Exchange, which offers subsidies to low-income residents under the Affordable Care Act.
Well, you're paying about two-thirds of it, with the federal government picking up about one-third, because they're paying $387 per month.
California is targeting more than 5 million residents for enrollment through the exchange. And in a state that already has a primary care provider shortage in many places, that has some lawmakers worried. State Senator Ed Hernandez says the problem is most extreme in rural and inner city areas.
So what we need to do is address those issues so that we can make sure we have enough primary care providers for everyone to be able to access health care.
This session, Hernandez introduced a set of three bills meant to increase the scope of practice of three medical fields. SB 493, which gives greater powers to pharmacists, is the only one that made it into law so far. Hernandez says around 40,000 pharmacists will now be able to interact with physicians and take on more primary care tasks. Tasks like
more vaccines, they can prescribe birth control. More importantly, with a physician, they could manage chronic disease, alter medications for chronic disease management. They can play a much bigger role to reflect their training and education to allow them to be much more integrated in the primary care and healthcare system.
The law says that pharmacists who do additional training will be certified as advanced practice pharmacists who can shoulder these roles and also prescribe medications for smoking cessation and other issues. Don Benton is Executive Vice President and CEO of the California Society of Health System Pharmacists.
Nationally, you know, we are really being, California is being saluted for being able to accomplish this. And other states are reaching out, trying to figure out how we were successful, because there can be great opposition when it comes to who's going to provide care.
In fact, there was opposition when the bill started out from the California Medical Association, or CMA. President Paul Finney says there wasn't enough language requiring collaboration with physicians.
You know, if a physician orders a particular drug regimen and the pharmacist would change it without letting the physician know, then the physician trying to treat the patient again might, without that information, would really be practicing blind, and that would not be good care. And the amendments we were able to achieve with the author helped to tighten that up.
CMA ultimately changed its position to neutral, but Finney says the organization did support another bill that should boost access to primary care SB 494 decreased the ratio of medical providers to patients required in managed care groups. It allows offices to take on more patients based on their number of nurse practitioners and physician assistants, or PAs.
It's an example of restructuring slightly in a way that's safe and effective, the teams that we use to provide care, and by optimizing and fully utilizing the training and experience of PAs, for example, expanding our capacity by working smarter, not harder.
SB 494 was co-sponsored by the California Association of Physician Groups.
In the future, what we need is we need less cowboys, we need more pit crews.
That's Bill Barcelona, the association's senior vice president of government affairs. Barcelona says it represents the kind of collaborative policies that will help address primary care shortages.
California is maybe middle of the pack to the bottom third in terms of progressiveness around the inclusion of health professionals in these care management teams.
Barcelona says this doesn't mean California doesn't have highly trained teams. He argues the state doesn't allow some practitioners to practice to the full extent of their training. He points to one bill that didn't pass this session. SB 491 would have allowed nurse practitioners to work independently without doctor oversight. But the California Medical Association's Finney says his group strongly opposed the policy change.
Ultimately, it leads to lower quality care and less integrated care and lower levels of safety.
The fight over this and another scope of practice bill that would expand the duties of optometrists is likely to continue in future sessions. In the meantime, the provider shortage is clearly on lawmakers' minds. Yet another bill that passed this session is SB 352. It allows supervised medical assistants to practice more of the duties for which they have been trained.
That was reporter Rachel Dornhelm from California Healthline, a daily news service of the California Healthcare Foundation. It's not just pharmacists that are in the news, it's also pharmaceuticals. The leftover prescription drugs you have around your house have become the center of a battle between small government and big pharmaceutical companies. A couple of counties on the West Coast are requiring drug makers to pay for the safe disposal of their products. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone in Sacramento has more about the new law in Alameda County.
Mary Hill has been accumulating prescription drugs in her Oakland office.
I have here morphine from people who have cancer. I have Vicodin.
Hill is a social service coordinator at a retirement home. She's been storing leftover drugs from residents who have died or don't know how to get rid of them safely.
This is methadone.
Hill doesn't want the drugs, but she doesn't want them to get into the hands of recreational users or into drinking water. If she drives away with the drugs, she could be stopped by police for possession of drugs that don't belong to her.
We don't want them to put it in the garbage bin outside. They can't flush it, so I don't know what to do.
Alameda County has a prescription drug disposal program. A couple of dozen locations, including pharmacies, police, and fire stations, provide bins for the collection of everything from narcotics to inhalers. But some people don't think that's enough.
Our program that's in place just isn't extensive enough. It needs to be much more convenient.
Nate Miley is an Alameda County supervisor. He authored a local ordinance that requires drug makers to design and pay for a comprehensive drug take-back program.
This is not something taxpayers should be paying for. It seems like when products have reached their life cycle, it should be the responsibility of the manufacturers to have a way of properly disposing of those products.
Alameda County's law is the first producer responsibility drug take-back program in the country. States and the federal government have considered similar measures, but none have passed.
We can't wait for Sacramento. We can't wait for the federal government. We were hoping that other counties would see what we've done and have the courage to follow our lead.
In fact, some California counties are reportedly considering similar laws. In Seattle, the King County Council has passed an ordinance like Alameda's. Pharmaceutical companies are noticing.
Running, if you will, a waste disposal authority is something that's really not in the institutional competence of manufacturers.
Mitt Spears is general counsel for Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association, or PhRMA. The trade group challenged the constitutionality of the Alameda County Ordinance in federal court and lost. Now it has appealed.
Local governments have been in the waste disposal business for a very, very long time, and they know more about it. They know more about how to take care of their citizens and what the needs are.
He says PhRMA is not opposed to take-back programs, but if pharmaceutical companies have to pay for them, the costs will be passed on to consumers.
We think it's unfair to basically put upon a Medicaid or a Medicare beneficiary in Tennessee a higher cost on their products so that we can pay for a state-of-the-art take-back program in Alameda, California.
Spears says PhRMA's legal challenge questions whether county governments can regulate interstate commerce. But Heidi Sanborn of the California Product Stewardship Council says that's not the question.
Is it the appropriate role of government to pay for the end of life for products put on the market that have an end of life cost? Or is it the appropriate role of the private sector to design life cycle systems that are basically cradle to cradle?
Sanborn says pushing manufacturers to be responsible for their waste makes them rethink production.
If they have an economic incentive that drives them to redesign and rethink the product, what it's made out of, how it works, how long it lasts, then we'll see hopefully greener design. And that's ultimately our goal.
Alameda County moved its deadline for drug companies to submit disposal plans to May of next year. Supervisor Miley says the county is also helping industry with the possible creation of a separate organization to administer the drug take-back. He says that could help prevent an eventual challenge of the law before the Supreme Court. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. California is a diverse state in just about every way, from our politics to our religions to our geography to our sports teams. In recent years, some have even questioned the notion of whether the Golden State is actually governable. Well, the people in Northern California's Siskiyou County are fed up with state government, and they're reviving efforts to break out on their own. State government reporter Katie Orr took a trip north to see what's driving the rejuvenated secession movement.
Siskiyou County is in extreme Northern California. Think of Sacramento and now imagine driving 4 hours north, just 22 miles from the Oregon border. That puts you in Yreka, the county seat. A lot of people living there are hoping one day the area can secede, join up with Southern Oregon, and create the state of Jefferson. At Yreka's Greenhorn Reservoir, Brian Peterson and his young daughter take a stroll in the frosty morning air. Peterson runs JeffersonState.com, a pro-secession website. He moved to the area when he was 18 and got a job in the timber industry. He says the industry and the town aren't what they used to be, and Peterson blames activist environmentalists colluding with the government.
To put the timber industry and the ranching industry and the mineral extraction industry out of business. I don't know what they want us to do. They want us to be all on welfare, I guess.
It's a view shared by many in the region. Liberal urban politicians in the state capital passing laws that limit long-held ways of life in Siskiyou County and beyond. The sentiment has been stirred up in the last couple of years after the state started charging a controversial fire protection fee to rural homeowners. As for the tax dollars Sacramento spends to support the region, Peterson says the capital can keep them.
They don't think we can support ourselves. Why do they need us? They should just cut us off and let us fend for ourselves. Well, this area was founded by pioneers who crossed the deserts and the plains and the mountains without any help from the government.
Peterson acknowledges it's not likely a new state will form anytime soon. Still, he says his role is just to keep the fire going. It's a fire that's been burning for generations. At the local Black Bear Diner, a group of men from the nearby Church of the Nazarene enjoy an early morning breakfast. Bill Golden has lived in Yreka for 18 years, and he's used to the secessionist talk.
Well, I don't see the state of Jefferson ever happening, but the reason for it makes sense because people want a voice. And when you live in a kind of rural area, you just don't seem to have a voice because the population centers dictate everything.
Across the table, Elliot Carroll, who's lived here for 60 years, is blunt about his opposition to the plan.
I don't think we can support a highways or a freeways, keep them maintained. We'd have to have a governor, we'd have to have a capital, we'd have to have the same people that's running the county now would be running the state, and I'm not too fond of those people.
Yeah. What do you really feel, Elliot?
Those anti-secession views don't faze Anthony and Tiso.
The bulk of the population wants to do it come hell or high water.
Intiso is standing in front of the Wairika Walmart collecting signatures on a petition to form the Republic of Jefferson Territory. The territory wouldn't replace the county or be separate from the state. In fact, many might call it a mostly symbolic gesture. Both the state and federal governments would need to approve secession. But Intiso sees the territory as the first practical step toward creating a new state. He says it would act as a framework for whatever future government might be set up should secession happen.
This is not some segment or special interest. This is a true republic form of governance.
Intiso believes if his measure makes it on the June 2014 ballot, it will pass. And judging from the number of enthusiastic shoppers stopping by to sign the petition,
we'll have a party when this happens.
It appears the State of Jefferson movement is still alive and well in the far northern reaches of California. I'm Katie Orr.
And this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
California, here I come. Right back where I started from. Where bowers of flowers bloom in the sun. Each morning at dawn and birdies singing. Everything a sun-kissed miss said. Don't be late. That's why I can't hardly wait. So open up your golden gates. California, here I come.
Space race to the fight against diseases like polio. The U.S. was once considered a scientific city on the hill, investing its resources and capital to improve the world's physical, social, and cultural infrastructure. But here in the 21st century, has America lost its moral compass when it comes to promoting science for the betterment of mankind? In this week's edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State biology professor Madhu Kati calls on all Americans to rekindle the commitment that for so long maintained America's scientific dominance that served humanity so well.
This is a peculiar moment to be a scientist in America. The United States has been the world's leader in advancing the frontiers of scientific discovery and a powerful beacon attracting students seeking enlightenment through science from the far corners of the world. That beacon was set alight by a generation of scientific geniuses, some born here, many migrating from Europe to escape the great wars of the 20th century. It burned fiercely in the decades following World War II when America donned the mantle not only of the political and economic leader of the free world, but also its scientific and cultural leader. That beacon, alas, began to dim towards the end of the 20th century and has been allowed to flicker in the first decades of this one. Just as this age began to fulfill science's promise, America, the leader that led us to this threshold, has faltered and dropped the baton of scientific progress. It was no accident that the beacon of science burned so brightly in America 50 years ago. It was an active choice by the American people, through their government, to fund the science and technology that established America as the world's leader. Yet, at the heights of that arc of progress, many Americans somehow decided, or were persuaded by forces of a new endarkenment, that paying taxes and investing in public goods was somehow inimical to the American drive for freedom from tyranny. Government of the people, by the people, for the people, bizarrely became painted as a tyranny that must be starved of taxes. It astonishes the world that these forces have succeeded in turning the U.S. government's lights off, quite literally this October, and starving higher education and science of the funding that made it the world's leader. It is no accident that the land that is home to the largest number of science Nobel laureates also has the highest proportion of people among developed nations who don't accept the facts of biological evolution, that the nation with the largest number of climate scientists and the most comprehensive coverage of weather on television, with whole channels dedicated to it, is also home to the greatest number of climate change denialists. It is not too late for America to relight the beacon of scientific discovery, to renew its commitment to invest in the public goods that made this country great. It is not too late for us to rediscover our heritage of government as a force for good when allowed, or rather made, to invest in the public goods that brought the greatest prosperity for the greatest number of people. That, one hopes, is one of the lessons learned from the recent government shutdown, which hit particularly hard the enterprise of science in this once, and hopefully again, beacon of enlightenment for the world. It sure is a peculiar time to be a scientist in America, but it doesn't have to remain so. For the moral is, this is Madhusudan Katti.
The Moral is a production of Valley Public Radio and the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment to learn more about the newest addition to Fresno's art scene. It's called the M Street Arts Project, and it's bringing together artists from around the community and soon graduate students from Fresno State to share in downtown's growing arts community. That's coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Over the past decade, downtown Fresno's art scene has blossomed with new galleries and studios, not to mention live-work lofts, and an area filled with public art that's been dubbed the Mural District. This month, there's a big new addition to that scene with something called the M Street Arts Complex by developer Granville Homes. It held its grand opening this past weekend, and this Thursday night, it will host its first Art Hop event. Joining us now is one of the artists who is the project curator for this facility and this new exhibit that is called Spectacle, A Closer Look at Fresno. We welcome to our program now Julia Wally Scott. Julia, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
Tell us about how this came about and what we're talking about here with this new facility. It's different than some of the other work exhibition spaces that are around in downtown Fresno.
Yes, this project came about, really it started from an Art Hop conversation. Darius Assemi visited my working studio and he was interested in my work he'd seen at the Fresno Art Museum. And between Darius and my partner Christina Rea, we started this conversation that became really a humongous idea and a leap of faith for Granville that they followed through on and built this 10,000 square foot section of a larger warehouse out as art studios, gallery spaces, and warehouse style studios as well. So it's different in that we created a dynamic based on what we would like to work in, the kind of spaces we would like to work in as artists. And one of those components is a gallery space with a private working studio attached. So artists are able to keep their in-progress work kind of separate from the public eye and then also present their work properly in a really well-lit gallery that has all the finishings.
So eventually artists are going to be renting out these individual spaces, these individual studios and galleries and exhibiting their own work there. But as this just opened on Saturday, this gives you an opportunity to take the whole space and do a big exhibit, and that's called Spectacle. Tell us about this.
So Spectacle was a project that Christina and I really believed needed to happen, and that was to curate the entire space before tenants could move into it or rent spaces with an exhibition. So the entire 10,000 square feet has been curated with hand-picked artists. There's 13 artists in the exhibition. All of their work is incredibly different. We have photographers, painters, printmakers, sculpture, video art, sound installation. It's incredibly engaging. And we wanted to, by the scale alone, catch the attention of the larger population of Fresno and to really change the dialogue from one of, you know, struggle to appreciating the tremendous art community that we have. And that's why we built this complex. So we wanted to show that with the exhibition. And we were able to highlight amazing work and to allow these artists who have not yet been recognized to their full potential to have the spotlight directly on them.
I was going to ask you about that. Looking at the list of artists who are a part of this, there are a few familiar names to people who follow the local arts community, but many of them would be probably new to a lot of people. Talk about who these people are.
Yeah, several of them are definitely well-respected within the art community already. But as far as the larger population, we knew that these would not be household names necessarily. So we have several people in the exhibition who have never had an exhibition before. This is their first show. But one of the people I'm referring to is David Aguirre, whose paintings are tremendous. They're like 11 feet tall. These giant, colorful, visceral paintings that have never been shown outside of an academic situation. And he was one of the stars of this exhibition for sure and has been getting a lot of attention. But we just chose the work because each of these artists has a tremendous dedication to what they're doing. And it's almost as if the work dictates the need to create it. They're just driven. It's passion that, you know, is behind what they're trying to do. So that's the current theme throughout the entire exhibition, is energy and this vibrance that I think reflects our community in a way that even the community itself wasn't aware of.
We're talking with local artist Julia Wally Scott. She is the project curator for a new exhibit called Spectacle, A Closer Look at Fresno. It is the first exhibit and it's the grand opening of the new M Street Arts Complex downtown. Where exactly is this?
This is at M and Tuolumne, which are both one-way streets, but we're right there on the corner. And it's directly across from the courthouse where you pay parking tickets.
Oh, well, people know where that is. Tell me about the Fresno State component, because Fresno State President Joseph Castro spoke at the grand opening, and Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities, Vita Samian, was there too. They have big plans for this as well. How does the graduate student program fit into this facility?
So the larger building is 22,000 square feet, and our half that I'm working with directly is 10,000 square feet of that. There is another section that has yet to be built out that Fresno State is working with Granville, and they intend to build graduate studios. I believe they want to build a gallery and lecture hall. So a downtown annex to their graduate program, which would be a tremendous infusion of energy into downtown, as well as keeping the academic realm relevant to what's happening in downtown, because we really do have a tremendous amount of energy building in this area, like you mentioned, blossoming.
Yeah, absolutely. And now if people are interested in seeing this exhibit, Art Hop is coming up Thursday night. That's the big first Thursday of the month event that takes place in the downtown area on the first Thursday. There's also a third Thursday of the month event throughout the rest of Fresno. But first Thursday of the month, that's this Thursday night. Tell us what's going on.
So we'll be open from 5 to 8, although I imagine we might stay a bit later than that. And
Art Hop has been known to go a little late into the night sometimes.
Yeah, we had a huge crowd for our grand opening, and we anticipate good numbers again. Essentially, just the entire space is filled with these amazing artists' work and energy and conversation and just this buzz that really is indicative of the growing sense of community in downtown.
Great. Well, again, congratulations on the work, and looking forward to seeing it this Thursday night for Art Hop. Again, our guest, Julia Wally Scott. She is the project curator for an exhibit called Spectacle, A Closer Look at Fresno, featuring 13 relatively unknown artists exhibiting their work at the brand new M Street Arts Complex in downtown Fresno. Julia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and follow us on Twitter. We're @kvpr. For reporter Rebecca Plevin, Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.